We continue our live commercial-free coverage of the Coronavirus Task Force press conference. The
White House Coronavirus Task Force met today. We continue at the president's direction to focus on slowing the spread of the coronavirus through mitigation, expanded testing, and ensuring that our healthcare workers have the supplies that they need. With cases now in all 50 states and more than 50% of cases in the New York area, it's more important than ever to adhere to the guidance of state and local authorities. And for every American, the best thing that you can do, young or old, is put into practice the president's coronavirus guidelines for America. It is the way that each of us can do our part. Since we last spoke, as you all know, the president signed the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. This makes direct payments available to American families. The average family of four will receive a direct payment of some $3,400. It also covers payroll for small businesses across the country for a period of several months so that even if the business is closed, they can continue to have a loan, which will be completely forgiven if they keep their whole team on the payroll. There's support for critical industries, for hospitals, and for states as well. As of this evening, the president has issued 12 major disaster declarations, most recently for the states of Maryland and Missouri. And on the subject of vaccines, Emory University in Atlanta today began enrolling volunteers in a phase one clinical trial of another possible vaccine for the coronavirus. On the subject of testing, testing is available in all 50 states, and as a great credit to our partnership with commercial laboratories across the country, this morning it was reported that more than 685,000 tests have already been performed, and we are particularly grateful to the American Hospital Association, whose members are now reporting into the CDC and FEMA in real time, giving our experts more visibility on those that have contracted the disease around the country. The president mentioned this, but it's worth mentioning again. Apple has a new app out. It is a screening tool that will help Americans determine whether they should be tested. It has a easy format, a question and answer. If you have issues about whether or not a test is appropriate for you, you can use the new Apple app to accomplish that as well. On the subject of supplies, and the president spoke about the priority that we're placing on personal protective equipment and especially ventilators, and I will not add to that. I can tell you that this weekend we'll be reporting on aggressive efforts that our Supplies Stabilization Task Force at FEMA is taking to import medical supplies from around the world. We're working as we speak on an airlift from a number of countries around the globe to deliver very important medical protective equipment to the United States. At the present moment, you've heard the numbers, but from the Strategic National Stockpile, we distributed more than 7 million N95 respirators or masks, more than almost 3 million face shields, more than 8,000 ventilators, and donations to the Strategic National Supply. We mentioned Apple donating some 9 million masks that can be used by healthcare workers, but Merck recently announced plans to donate 500,000 masks, USPS, 500,000 masks, and a little company called Puritan in Maine is actually in the business now of manufacturing swabs. So businesses large and small all across America are rising to the challenge. As the president noted, he will attend the embarkation of the U.S. Navy ship Comfort tomorrow from Norfolk. The U.S. Navy ship Mercy arrived in Los Angeles today. We will continue to focus resources and supplies on those areas around the country that have seen significant outbreak. But let me send a word to hospital workers around the country country. We continue to hear anecdotally and occasionally see in media reports people who have concerns that their hospital may be running short on personal protective equipment in the days ahead. We just encourage you to alert your hospital administrator. Hospital administrators, please alert your state health director. Tonight, Administrator Gaynor at FEMA will be speaking to all of the state emergency directors in America to talk about the availability of resources, but also encouraging them to have a plan to perhaps even use their National Guard to move medical equipment from storehouses to hospitals. We'll be working very closely with state emergency managers on issues of logistics. But today, we're fortunate to be joined by two members of the cabinet who have been very busy making sure that the children of America have the meals that they need while school has been suspended in so many places around the country. Secretary DeVos and Secretary Perdue are going to share some exciting news and progress that we've made in feeding children who need nutrition assistance while schools are closed. The truth is many underprivileged kids would not be getting school meals apart from the fact that as we stand here today, our administration has approved waivers for all 50 states to give them flexibilities to work with local partners to get meals to children that are in need, and also a nationwide waiver to allow parents to pick up meals. But what's most exciting today is our two cabinet secretaries will reflect, we have private sector partners, a few of whom are with us today, who are helping us speed important meals to children and to families around the country. You'll hear in a few moments from the chairman of McLane Global Logistics and also the CEO of Panera Bread about the work that they are both doing to literally deliver millions of meals to American families. It's truly an inspiring story, and I look forward to hearing it from them and sharing it with you. But it's just one more example, as President Trump said, that we'll get through this, and we'll get through this together. Not only a whole of federal government approach, working with all of our state partners, working with health care authorities at the local level, but also working with businesses that have been willing to step up and stand at the point of the need and be there for the most vulnerable and help us meet the needs of our children and of our families. And on behalf of the President and a grateful nation, we thank you. Madam Secretary.
Secretary Betsy DeVos of Education.
Thank you so much, Mr. Vice President. And I just want to begin by thanking President Trump for his clear-eyed leadership during these challenging times for our country and for our world. And Vice President Pence, for your tremendous leadership of the task force and for truly making a difference that's certainly true for America's students and teachers as well. Most of them, as Owen said a moment ago, experiencing unprecedented disruptions in learning and in their lives. I want each of them to know that President Trump and his administration are taking decisive action to keep them safe and healthy so they can continue learning. We must rise to the challenge of educating all children from all walks of life who all of a sudden are in many, many different learning environments, and they're counting on all of us to find solutions. I'm really pleased to be here today for the announcement of another terrific solution initiated under the President's leadership. Secretary Perdue is going to share details of this public-private partnership, but before that, I'd like to provide a few additional comments and talk about the work that the Department of Education has been doing on behalf of students, parents, and teachers during this national emergency. My team and I are in contact daily with governors, state school chiefs, college presidents, superintendents, and local education leaders. We are quickly responding to their needs so they can do the next right thing for their students. Most governors have decided to close some or all schools in their states for a period of time. As a result, students may not be able to take federally mandated standardized tests this spring. And the president took action to make sure they didn't have to. We made the process to delay these tests for a year fast and painless. As of today, 47 states have requested the delay or the waiver, and 46 have been approved within a 24-hour period. We also released additional information making clear the expectation that education will continue for all students. The transition to distance and online learning needs to happen quickly. and it needs to include meaningful instruction and supports for children with disabilities. Learning should not stop or be denied because schools fear federal regulators or fear doing something different. Distance learning is happening. States like New Hampshire and Florida have implemented phased and tiered approaches to meet the needs of students in their states. Other schools and states are implementing creative approaches and working through practical realities to help students continue learning. In remote Colorado mountain towns without internet connectivity, teachers are putting weekly learning packets together and they're holding office hours by phone to help their students when they're stuck. South Carolina is deploying 3,000 buses with mobile Wi-Fi hotspots to help kids in remote areas access learning that way. This national emergency gives all of us an opportunity to come together to educate all students out of principle. It's simply not an acceptable option to educate none of them out of fear. So we stand ready to assist educators and their students. We're compiling all of the tools we have produced, along with the great resources that states are offering to help keep learning going. There are already many existing online learning platforms, and many states were already offering a robust menu of courses virtually. We will be adding that information to our website on an ongoing basis, and that site is ed.gov/coronavirus. We're using every tool possible to extend flexibility to states and communities. This includes funding flexibility. Where we don't have the latitude, we're working with Congress on solutions. One area is providing direct financial support to students, families, and teachers. We will propose Congress provide microgrants to help students continue to learn. These would be focused toward the most disadvantaged students in our states or communities where their school system has simply shut down. I've always believed education funding should be tied to students, not systems, and that necessity has never been more evident. We'll also support microgrants to teachers to help them pivot to supporting all of their students in a different environment than they've been used to. We know they are dealing with an unprecedented situation, but it's been truly inspiring to hear story after story of teachers rising to the occasion and meeting the unique needs of each of their students. Ultimately, we know everyone's grappling with the challenge of keeping students safe and healthy while also building capacity for remote learning. It's an important moment to realize that learning can and does happen anywhere and everywhere. I think of the Texas dad who started a daily webinar interviewing friends and acquaintances in wildly different careers and helping students understand what it takes to work in that chosen career. Or the history teacher in Virginia who connects with his students through a live stream every morning. I think of the art teacher in Tennessee who's broadcasting her lessons over social media, or of Second Lady Karen Pence, who prepares packages of art materials and projects for her students to pick up with their school lunches, or the principal in Alabama who's going online daily, giving morning announcements, leading the Pledge of Allegiance, and a moment of silence. And I think of the many schools that have distributed laptops and tablets to students who don't have them so they can continue learning over video conference. And the ones that just don't have that option currently, like the remote Colorado towns. Joy Hoffmeister, the school chief in Oklahoma, may have put this best. She told me, "School isn't a building. It's students, teachers, and families working together to advance learning." She's right, and that's our shared mission. Let me also touch very briefly on how we're supporting students pursuing higher education. At the beginning of this outbreak, we immediately gave institutions of higher education regulatory flexibility so learning could go online, and it did. In many cases, it was a seamless transition, and learning continues. And we're continuing to cut federal bureaucracy and let schools rise to meet this challenge. We've vastly improved distance learning policies, which are working quickly to enact for traditional higher education. Shorter-term programs and apprenticeships also need to grow and thrive. And as the president has so effectively championed, workers need these options as they look to come back stronger than ever from these momentary setbacks. The president promised to defeat this invisible enemy and keep our economy strong. He took immediate action and provided student loan relief to tens of millions of borrowers. We set all federally held student loans to 0% interest rates and deferred payments for 60 days. Now, with the CARES Act that he signed just earlier today, Mr. President, Those actions will extend to 6 months. We hope these actions and others we've taken for those who become delinquent on payments or have had other issues with their student loan payments will help alleviate the financial burden and anxiety students and their families are feeling during these tough times. These are tough times, but we, the people, are tougher. So in closing, let me offer just a few words of encouragement. To our students, your educations can and should continue. Learning can happen anywhere, and we will help make sure it does. We believe in you. To our teachers, we will support you and help you. You are doing great work. Keep it up. And to every parent and family, we know these are challenging times, but it's in the face of great challenges that Americans have always risen to the occasion and embraced greatness. And I know we'll do that once again. I thank again the President and the Vice President for their leadership on behalf of America's students and on behalf of all of us. And now I'll turn to my friend Secretary Sonny Perdue to share more on how we're working together to help support student nutrition.
Secretary Perdue of the Department of Agriculture, you're listening to live coverage on KTTH.
Educators are out there trying to continue to fill our kids with knowledge even when they're not in a school site. USDA is working very hard to continue to fill their tummies. You may know that many of these children receive breakfast and lunch at their school sites, and our federal government participates with our dedicated school nutritional and lunch professionals throughout the country, and we have issued waiver after waiver to make this flexibility available for things that make sense when children cannot congregate in a singular location. That's one of the first waivers we issued, and when Congress gave us the authority to issue more, we are turning those waivers around rapid speed, really less than 24 hours. So we're very fortunate that we've got a great team at our Food, Nutrition, Consumer Services team working 24/7 to make sure that our kids continue to be fed. It's a great partnership that's happening out there. I want to mention one other simple but very important point about another matter that your listeners and readers may be very interested in. That's the food supply chain. USDA obviously is intimately involved in the food supply chain. We've worked with all those producers, even the ones who provide the equipment and materials for our farmers and cattlemen and producers out there, to make sure they have what they need. They're part of the critical and essential workforce there to continue. And the good news is those folks are staying on the job. Those who've grown it, those who are processing it, our inspectors who are grading it just the same way they always had, those folks who are delivering it, packing it, delivering it, stocking those shelves, and checking out those customers. That's the great news about our food supply chain, and it's a great American story. Mr. Vice President, under your leadership, the President's leadership, this is that whole of America approach. Federal government can't do it all, but we got great partners out there in the food supply chain, as well as our food nutrition services and our partners in our school nutrition services, doing a great job to continue to get these meals to kids there. Two of our private sector partners are here with us today. I'd like for them to tell their story, because it's a great story. Denton McLean with McLean Global here has partnered with Baylor, a collaborative on poverty and hunger, along with PepsiCo, in order to pack 1 million meals a week to deliver to rural kids who might not can get to town to these drop-off sites where the other kids are picking up meals. And again, Niren McChaudhry, Niren Chaudhry of Panera Bread, CEO of Panera Bread. Their company is also participating in Columbus, Ohio, with the Children Hunger Alliance there to deliver food meals that meet the regulations of USDA under flexible conditions there, to get food meals there. And Panera is looking to expand that to nationwide as well. So, Denton, why don't you come and tell us your story? Thank you very much.
You're listening to live coverage on AM 770 KTTH and the Jason Rancho. This is the Coronavirus Task Force. You're now hearing from the CEO of Panera Bread as they talk about the private sector's impact on taking on some of the issues due to the coronavirus.
Right now, there's a lot of focus on our large cities and the enormous challenges that they face. But imagine this. You live in Iberia Parish, Louisiana, or you live in the Nome Borough in Alaska. Your schools are closed, and normally your children get two meals a day at school. Both parents are working from home, but mom and dad just can't get to work, get to town where meals are being offered for pickup. That's about to change, and change for the better. Because of this USDA program, McLane Global will source, secure, receive, organize, assemble, package, label, and then deliver boxes straight to a child's home. And here's another big difference. For the first time, we'll be able to offer shelf-stable meals that will last 2 weeks. That's a true game changer for rural families. It's happening because of the president's order to do whatever it takes to get the job done. Everyone knows that tons of paperwork can be like lighter fluid for a great idea. And this is a great idea. We field tested it in 2019 and it worked. You've heard today about the administration's work on this project. Here are some other important partners in this effort. We have Baylor University. They will provide sponsorship and oversight. In addition, we are deeply appreciative to UPS and the United States Postal Service, and we are joined by PepsiCo Company to help get this accomplished. Because of this collaboration and our tireless employees, I can report to you the boxes are ready to ship. And after all, this is all about the children who must be fed during this crisis. We stand ready to serve. Thank you, Mr. President and Mr. Vice President, for caring about the specific needs for the children who live in rural America. Thank you.
You're listening to live coverage of the coronavirus press conference. The IRS is increasing the number of officers in Washington State. And if you owe money, they're going to come for you. Don't try to take on the IRS yourself. Contact our local tax expert and advocate, Greg Nunn, at Nunn Better Tax Resolution. N-U-N-N, Nunn Better Tax Resolution. We return to the live press conference.
For the opportunity. This is an extraordinary time, and I passionately believe that at such times we must all come together and do our very, very best to contribute and make a difference. At Panera, our mission is simple. It is about ensuring that good food is accessible to everyone, especially those who are the most vulnerable, such as children, and especially at a time like this. And we are absolutely determined to make a difference in this regard. Today, we are announcing a partnership with USDA and Children's Hunger Alliance to serve freshly prepared, wholesome meals to children in the entire state of Ohio to begin with, and hopefully after that to expand that program across many other states in the country. I do believe that the human experience, indeed life, is all about having resilience in the face of adversity and also having the tenacity to just keep going, to just keep going. And at Panera, our associates and our franchise partners live that spirit every single day. They are resilient and they are tenacious. And on their behalf, I pledge that we are committed to do the right thing for the country and help serve those who need it the most at this very important time. We are ready to serve. Thank you very much.
Outstanding. Thank you so much.
Vice President Mike Pence.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your business's incredible generosity. And I'll actually allow the two business leaders to step out if you'd like. We appreciate you so very much on behalf of the president and a grateful nation. Before we go to questions, I'm going to invite Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci to step forward with a few reflections on what we're seeing in the data. And as you all are aware, over the next several days, our team will be assembling recommendations for the president to give further guidance to the American people, to states around the country, and they can both share with you the importance of ongoing efforts of mitigation by every American, the need to support what state and local leaders guidance is to every American community, but also as Dr. Birx continues to work carefully with the modeling, analyzing the data, she'll reflect on the progress we've been made in that. Deborah?
Great. Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Just to pick up on some of the questions that you had earlier. So the issues that we discussed with the modeling yesterday was to ensure that the models were adjusted for the great work that every citizen is making in doing the mitigation efforts, and to see if that was reflected in the request specifically for ventilators. And so we wanted to make sure that with a limited number of ventilators and the issues that we saw in Detroit and Dearborn, in Cook County, and now in New Orleans, that we were balancing and projecting correctly based on both what the models had predicted and then whether they were adjusted for the incredible mitigation work ongoing in New York City. We understand that this week and next week will not reflect that mitigation, whether it's New Orleans or whether it's New York and the New York metro area. We know that the hospital admissions that we are seeing this week and next week will be infections that occurred before the mitigation started. But we wanted to make sure going forward that the needs reflected that. That was what was adjusted in the Ferguson model for the UK, and I know you're following that very carefully. They believe strongly that the mitigation methods that were put into place that informed our mitigation methods, we all were working off of that same model, and I want to make it clear that those models, those flu models, have been incredibly helpful to really predict what would layering of these different mitigation methods, from social distancing to staying home if you're sick, to staying in that household, that had quarantined everybody in the household if anyone is positive. Now, there are other countries that took different approaches, and I want to be clear, because we did hear from both China and South Korea. But it's always important that you adopt and adapt, and adapt it to your community and the reality of your country. We do this around the world. You can't ever just take an off-the-shelf approach and then put it into action in your community. You have to understand your communities. And so although both China and South Korea removed people who were positive from their households and segregated them away from their families, we did not think that our Americans would adopt and adapt to that situation. And so that's why in our guidelines, we asked people if there is a family member to try to self-isolate in the household and so that that person is still there in the household. So I just wanted to be clear that, yes, we all heard about what China and South Korea did. As much as we could, we adapted them to the American situation, as the UK has done also. And we just wanted to be really ensured that all of the requests for the stockpile reflected the great work that the American citizens were doing in each of these areas to ensure health. And then finally, I know there was a question about requiring quarantine. I want to make sure that everyone understood when we talked about New York residents who had gone to other places, it was for them to voluntarily self-isolate and take care of themselves because we felt like they could be exposed. And we really wanted to alert them that the rates in New York City were high and were increasing, and that they were probably exposed during some of the most exposure time period before the mitigation efforts went in. So this was really about a health of our New York citizens that then chose to go to other places, both to protect themselves and to protect others. So hopefully that's clear to everyone about those issues. We continue to look at the data every day. We really want to applaud the laboratory testing that is helping us. It will help us very much when we can get full surveillance up in many of our communities and surveillance around those most vulnerable, particularly in nursing homes and long-term care facilities, so that we can more rapidly test both the workers and the occupants in those communities. Thank you.
That was Dr. Deborah Birx. This is Anthony Fauci.
Today, just a few hours ago, I had the opportunity to get on a telephone call with the people who are on the front lines, the people who are actually in the ICUs or in the hospitals from all of the areas that are being hardly hit, including New York. And I'm not a supply person. I'm a physician, a scientist, and I do vaccines and I do drugs. But I am a member of the task force, and I do take very seriously the responsibility that we have to those individuals to get them the material that they need. We've heard discussions about this, ventilators, personal protective equipment, masks, and things like that. They are doing an amazing job up there. And I just want to have a message to them, which I told them over the phone, that as a member of the task force with my colleagues here, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that they get everything they need at the time that they need that, because they are doing an amazing job up there, and I salute them. Thank you.
Great. We'll take a few questions.
Just a quick one to Dr. Birx.
Yes, please.
I asked you, I think it was about 8 or 9 days ago, about the data from all these tests, and you had suggested that there would soon be a website where we would see all the data. Are we closer to that? When do you expect that? Do you have any data to give us tonight? As far as I can tell, this has not been publicly released yet.
Yeah, no, thank you. I've learned, as Tony has described, we've learned that when a community is educated, we all do better together. And so it's important to get that information out when we start talking about where the virus is, what the percent positives are, and really inform communities so that they can make decisions, so that people can take protective measures for themselves and for their families. And I find that it's important, yes, for us to have the data, but it's equally important for the state and local governments as well as the communities. We are still, because we worked very hard to get it into the first bill, but it was changed to state and local labs, and obviously 95% of all the tests are being done in the commercial labs. So in this recent bill that was just approved, it is mandated that all commercial labs need to report. And so you'll have that data when we get the data comprehensively from all the commercial labs. Well, it was passed today, so hopefully we'll expect it tomorrow.
Guys, only one more question.
About the guidelines, if I can, Dr. Birx, Dr. Fauci, whomever. What is the testing standard here? Are you going to need to test people who are well or only people who are symptomatic? Obviously, let's say in an Omaha, 10 people walk into a hospital, 5 come in, they're all tested positive, 5 go home, they may still be positive. What is your standard in order to make these recommendations?
So I'm glad you asked, because the important thing about testing, it only tells you if you're positive or negative that day. You could become positive the next day. And so testing should be used intentionally as a surveillance tool or a diagnostic tool. And I think what we're going to work on over the weekend is to weave together both a testing strategy for surveillance, which you have brought up in that key point, while maintaining a strong testing for diagnosis. Because our first obligation is still to ensure that patients get diagnosed, both so that the personal protective equipment for those who are negative doesn't have to be utilized, but also to give those patients the opportunity to have optimal care. And I think Dr. Fauci mentioned this a few minutes ago. The things we have learned over the last just 3 months was a lot of information about how best to ventilate patients. I think that has been shared across communities and across clinicians around the globe. We never previously had an experience where a lot of people had to be ventilated prone. So this kind of information that has been shared has been critical to improve the survival of the patients that we have in the United States of America. And we really want to applaud the countries who've been giving all of us that information and sharing it across the clinical network.
One quickly to Dr. Bench, if I could. Dr. Fauci, Sunday will mark 1 month since the first death from this new disease. I wanted to ask you a bit of a philosophical question. I've known you for 25 years. You've been through HIV, AIDS, MERS, SARS, West Nile virus, Ebola, all of that. How has this nation changed since that first death 1 month ago?
Well, this is truly an unprecedented situation that we're going through. As you mentioned correctly, John, I have been through everything from the very beginning of the very uncertain days with HIV/AIDS. Cumulatively, if you look at what's happened with HIV/AIDS over the 37 and a half, 38 years that we've had it, the burden and the suffering and the death has been enormous, historic. But it came over a period of time. There was the fright in the beginning. What we're seeing now in actual real time is something that's unprecedented. This is something that we have never seen before, at least in our generation. They've seen something maybe like this back 100 years ago. And we're really being challenged to not only learn in real time, to be able to respond in a way that is helpful and effective. But we're also in uncharted waters. And I think that's the thing that I find different, is that the waters are uncharted, so that it isn't as if we have an example of how to do it. You know, we have an extraordinary confrontation on the health and the welfare of the globe, particularly, you know, for us here in the United States. So as somebody who has been through all of those outbreaks, this truly is unprecedented. So from the first day to now, the first death, we've been through something that no one has ever experienced in our generation.
Let me say good evening to each one of you. I trust this was helpful. We'll continue to keep you informed. Over the course of the weekend, the president will be traveling to Norfolk for the embarkation of the U.S. Navy ship Comfort. Our task force will be meeting through the course of the weekend, and we'll be reviewing the data and preparing recommendations for the American people going forward. But thank you all for your time and attention.
You're listening to live coverage of the coronavirus press briefing. That, of course, earlier on was President Donald Trump, followed by Vice President Mike Pence. We heard from Drs. Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx at the end. And then earlier we heard from two secretaries, Betsy DeVos of Education, Sonny Perdue of Agriculture. They went over a lot of information earlier on. They mentioned that they were, in fact, pushing the button on the Defense Production Act, which essentially says that the U.S. government has the authority to force a private American company to move forward with production of certain types of material. Specifically, they talked about GM and Ventec. Ventec, by the way, is a local company out of Bothell, but GM had the most airtime today in this press conference. GM, the president said, they ran into some roadblocks. The implication was that there was concerns over pricing, that we were getting priced higher than we should given the circumstances to create ventilators. So the president detailed that they are, in fact, moving forward now with both GM and Ventec after utilizing the Defense Production Act, which the president, up until this point, has been wary to use for a good reason. When we're talking about Republican ideals and values, we generally err on the side of not forcing the government into forcing you into taking a position. And he's been reluctant for that purpose. But at some point, the president decided, yeah, you guys are not doing the right thing on your own, and you're not necessarily acting fairly. At least that was the implication of the earlier comments. And so he moved forward with it, and now they are on the same page. He also gave a shout-out, several shout-outs to Boeing, indicating that they're actually creating and donating these face shields for, you know, the folks who are on the front lines of this fight for the coronavirus. So that was an interesting tidbit. Again, a local issue getting national attention. So, too, did Governor Jay Inslee. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Jason Rant Show. I'm actually broadcasting from my home. We're going through a little bit of a test period of what it would be like if I couldn't leave the apartment, just like a lot of people right now are on day two of the stay-at-home order. Earlier, the president went after Governor Jay Inslee, calling him out just moments ago.
I think we've done a great job for the state of Washington, and I think the governor, who's a failed presidential candidate, as you know, he leveled out at zero in the polls. He's constantly chirping, and I guess complaining would be a nice way of saying it. We're building hospitals. We've done a great job for the state of Washington.
There was a moment yesterday, news came out late in the day, that they got into it a little bit, Governor Jay Inslee and President Donald Trump, over the sort of the leadership coming from the state. They said they didn't want a backup plan. They wanted the president to move forward a little bit more. They wanted, Inslee said, a Tom Brady, which is a weird comment to make, given that we have a Russell Wilson right here. You would think he would use that person as an example. He didn't. So there's been some concern between the White House, the administration, and the governor's office as to whether or not they're going to be able to work together. We know that just about a month ago, the governor, Jay Inslee, went on Twitter and he tried to flex against Mike Pence about how he's being tough and making sure that the federal government pays attention to science the way that Governor Jay Inslee pays attention to science. Governor Inslee, of course, not really able to understand some basic science textbooks, which is why he only says we focus on science without actually delivering any science.
He calls all the governors. I tell him, I mean, I'm a different type of person. I say, Mike, don't call the governor of Washington. You're wasting your time with him. Don't call the woman in Michigan. Well, it doesn't make any difference what happens.
Call the governor of Washington?
No, you know what I say? If they don't treat you right, I don't call. He's a different type of person. He'll call quietly anyway, okay? But he's done a great job. He should be appreciated for the job he's done.
So there are folks online from CNN and the New York Times indicating that clip said that Trump said he's not going to call. He's not having Pence call Washington. But, of course, at the end, he was very clearly saying he will, in fact, allow the vice president to call Jay Inslee. We've got a lot to talk about in this truncated show of the Jason Rand Show, most of it taken over by the uninterrupted coverage of the coronavirus task force. I hope you appreciate that we carry all of it uninterrupted so that you can actually hear directly from the people who are in charge. We know that a local radio station, KOW, that's the local NPR station, choosing not to carry any of the Trump press briefings because they get triggered by his voice. We actually care about this community. We actually care about making sure you get information that you need. So we will continue to carry those live. But lots of stuff happening locally and nationally. We're going to get into it when we come back. If you want to send me a text, 1-800-465-8770. If you have any questions about what's going on, we will help you navigate all of this in the coronavirus crisis. We return when we come back. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Welcome back to The Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH, a truncated version today, of course, because we played the full uninterrupted press briefing coming from the president. We're going through a slightly different type of show because I'm actually not in the studio in Eastlake. I am in my apartment doing this show, not because I am self-quarantining, but because everyone at the office is all like, you know what, we don't need you here. You can stay at home. We now actually have an excuse to get rid of you. That was what producer Peyton had said. Lots of stuff happening today. Obviously, we are officially into day two of the coronavirus stay-at-home directive coming from Governor Jay Inslee. It's going to hit every person who's listening to me right now. It's going to hit every single person in the state of Washington in a variety of ways. Some directly from a health perspective, right? Someone who might get COVID-19. Someone who is dealing directly with the savages of the coronavirus. Others are parents who have their kids home. Oh, gosh, you have your kids home and you can't get rid of them. And it's going to be a while. Others are not able to work at all. Some are. But they're going to have to do a telecommuting unless they work in an essential job. But right now, what we're told is the state of Washington has this under control. They now have Raquel Bono in charge. She is a retired Navy vice admiral. She's in charge of the response to the coronavirus outbreak here in Washington state. To give you some context as to who she is, her last job in the military was coordinating the healthcare systems operated by the Army, Navy, and Air Force. So this is someone who comes with a lot of experience. And she had the opportunity to speak with Cairo 7 TV to explain, look, I will be coordinating with hospitals, assisted living centers, all of the testing laboratories to make sure everyone's talking with one another.
We have to bring to bear all levels of the state, from the state governor's office to the medical associations to the different communities and both the public and private sectors here.
So it's a lot of moving pieces happening at the same time. And unlike the traffic czar in the city of Seattle, it sounds like she's actually going to do something. It sounds like she's going to be a key part of figuring out where are military field hospitals that are on their way to Washington. Where exactly are they going to go?
What we're looking at is an early April timeline for when we can have those all together and put up and running.
Now, the question is, are we too late? That's what some people are saying. In fact, that's kind of what Bill Gates is saying. He was on CNN last night. He said, not only do we need to just close down Washington state in the way that we've already been done, we got to do this to the entire country.
So we're entering to a tough period that if we do it right, we'll only have to do it once for 6 to 10 weeks. But we have to do it. It has to be the whole country. And having states go at different things or thinking you can do it county by county, that will not work. The cases will be exponentially growing anywhere you don't have a serious shutdown.
No, of course. And that was MSNBC. Excuse me. Of course, that's not very realistic, is it? You're not able to close down the entire country for that long. I get his point, and his point is valid, right? The more closed down that we can be as a country, the faster we're going to be able to get this under control. But the fact of the matter is, that's not very realistic. It is maybe in small pieces of the country, small parts of the country, and then when you're in an emergency situation like you are in New York, California, Louisiana, here in Washington, yes, you're going to be able to do that. But you're not going to be able to make that point to Idaho and New Mexico and Arizona and Kansas because they haven't been hit quite the same. Now, of course, there's the potential for them to be hit the same. There is. It's true. But the fact of the matter, and the president has been right about this, we can't keep this closed down forever. And while no one is saying that we're sort of devaluing human life, we are saying that the cure can't be worse than the disease. And so we got to first get the disease in check. You're never going to completely get it in check until you get a vaccine and you get a treatment, right? But obviously you're not going to get that within a year. And so are we supposed to be closed down, as Bill Gates says, for a year? Now, maybe Bill Gates, uber millionaire, billionaire, can do that. But most people can't. And so we got to be smart about this. We got to be putting ourselves in a position to mitigate this. Now, we've heard from Dr. Deborah Birx. We've heard from Dr. Anthony Fauci over and over and over again, saying that they're going to allow the data to dictate where it is they're going. But you've already heard from Dr. Birx over the last couple days already, saying, slow your roll, media. You guys are really leaning in to the doomsday predictions, and the data does not back that up. Now, when you look at New York, it's going to be a significantly different picture than looking at New Mexico. When you look at Washington, it's going to be different than looking at Oregon. But their job at a federal government level is to look at the entirety of the country, not just a few states. That's why they've been so persistent in pushing this on to state governors when appropriate. They'll provide the guidance, but it's up to the states. Now, meanwhile, here in the Seattle area, we are downplaying the concerns associated with the coronavirus crisis, specifically as it relates to public safety. You're hearing from the SPD, you're hearing from the city of Seattle that we're not necessarily having a rush in crime according to the data. But what we do know is King County is no longer allowing for bookings of the vast majority of misdemeanor cases. Now, they're still making arrests, but what ends up happening is you make the arrest and the person's out of jail within hours. And a lot of times we're talking about prolific offenders like Francisco Calderon, who, believe it or not, yesterday at 11 p.m., he was arrested. Allegedly for threatening to stab someone with a syringe. And apparently, he also used the N-word in a verbal assault against a Seattleite. Gets booked into jail about, I believe, 1 a.m. Gets released today at 1 p.m. So that's not meaningful, right? This is someone who is most likely going to go back into the community and commit more acts of terror against individual neighborhoods. Because that's what, he's not a terrorist, but he's terrorizing. When you're someone who is convicted 75 times, you're going a little bit too far, right? But Seattle wants to downplay all of this. Okay, fine. You can downplay all of the crime that you'd like, but downplay it to Ivy Chan at Jade Garden in Seattle. It's a restaurant. Because she spoke to Como TV. She said her and her family, they showed up to their restaurant Thursday morning, and guess what they found? Part of the glass storefront completely smashed in. Now, she doesn't know if someone was trying to break in or just cause some damage. But now her family might end up covering all of the windows in plywood.
We're talking about trying to do that just to be safer and make sure that no one breaks in.
So does that sound like we've got the crime situation under control? Adrienne Bandlow owns Holy Cannoli. She also tells Como TV that thieves at her store broke in and were very clearly experienced.
It's a heavy piece of equipment, so it wasn't very easy. So they knew what they were doing.
You know what they tried to, what they ended up stealing? The cash register. This is what we're having happen here in the Seattle area. That's what's happening. And it's happening because of the coronavirus crisis is leading to really, really bad decisions. Decisions that on paper, I understand. You're saying that you don't end up wanting, you don't want to just put a whole bunch of people from the public into jails because they could have COVID-19 and then the coronavirus spreads within the jail cell, not only impacting the prisoners, but impacting the staff members. I get that. But for example, when you've got someone who is a prolific offender, can we not look at that case and say, okay, let's just put that person in behind bars? And is it really smart for the city to put out a press release about this, basically telling everyone that this is happening? Now, of course, we're having more and more stories of individuals who are impacted by this. There's some sad stories. King 5 has one out right now. A restaurant icon in this area. She died from the coronavirus. Her name was Liz Marr. She was 72, so she was in that age group that is at a higher risk of mortality as a result of contracting COVID-19. She was the owner of Kona Kitchen, which is a very, very popular Hawaiian restaurant out here. Her husband, Robert, who's 78 years old, he also has coronavirus. He's struggling in acute care at Northwest Hospital. This all according to their daughter. And it is yet again another tragic reminder of what is going on right now in this fight against COVID-19. And it's important because people are still taking the position of, oh, well, do we really need to close everything down? Do you need to close everything down? Well, tell that to the families that are being directly impacted by this. Tell that to the families who are losing their grandparents or their mothers or their fathers and grandparents. Tell that to them. Tom Cotton had a really good point to be made. We'll play just a short clip and then we'll take a break.
If we give up on our efforts to control this virus now, our medical system will be overwhelmed. Hospitals will collapse. Care will be rationed. Doctors will face the terrible choice of whom to save and whom to let perish.
Do you want that to happen to your grandparents? You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. More coverage when we come back right here on KTTH.